This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
You can reach us at Nation Radio or the team1260.com. We're also on Twitter at It's Nation Radio. And starting today, going through to the night of the draft, obviously you're going to have to email before the draft begins. Nation Radio is conducting our first contest. The prize will be an authentic Oiler jersey with the name of Edmonton's first pick at the 2011 entry draft on the back, and that is for you. And we'll try to make it the old-timey one, the throwback jersey. Wanya is going to secure that for us. You can email your top 10. You can do it now or wait until later to Nation Radio at the team1260.com, and we'll award the jersey to the person who can correctly identify the top 10. You don't have to list the team, but just the top 10. We're going to get two jerseys, one for the winner and one for my good friend Kent Wilson from Flames Nation, because we want him to have that gorgeous Oiler copper and blue jersey with the name of Ryan Nugent Hopkins on it. How are you, Kent?
Good. That's not quite the prize I would ask for, but I appreciate that.
Well, that's also your pay for the next year from Flames.
Oh, fantastic.
Hey, I'm not going to be an ass about this, but the Tim Erickson thing must have caused, you know, a lot of, you know, bad feelings, or at least, you know, for the Flames fans, that can't have been a good day.
No, being a Flames fan has been like absorbing a lot of gut punches the last couple of years, and that's just another one in a series. He was by far the top prospect in an organization that doesn't have a lot of top prospects. So it was really rough to lose him.
Ryan Lambert wrote on the Flames Nation site, Calgary, the new Edmonton. Is there a sense of, and I don't think there should be, because obviously, you know, the Flames didn't make the playoffs this year, but there's a thread of, you know, a lot of playoffs and a Stanley Cup final there in the not too distant past. Is there a feeling like that was a real tough kick to the gut, like you were looking forward to this kid? Or is there a feeling like, hey, you know what, the payback wasn't that bad?
Well, I think, first in Calgary being the new Edmonton, I think what happened over the last 2 years is, you know, usually when teams pick kids, they spend the time evaluating them after their draft. And I think what happened with Erickson is he was evaluating the organization as well, because he was in Sweden playing professionally there. And he probably just looked at what was happening in Calgary over the last two seasons, which are, you know, two of the worst seasons they've had as an organization in a number of ways, and he probably looked back and said, no thanks. So it's probably too early to say, you know, Calgary's a new Edmonton and, you know, people aren't going to want to play there, but I think they're sort of traveling down that road where, you know, the best players have aged considerably. They haven't made the playoffs in a couple of years. There's not a lot of you know, up-and-comers to fill the gap. So I don't know. They're still a competitive team, but I can see 2 or 3 years down the road where, you know, there isn't a lot of difference between Calgary and Edmonton in terms of climate and the city. It's just Calgary's been more competitive the last few years, which would make them more desirable as a destination. So if they're not competitive anymore, it's very likely that they could be, you know, at the bottom of a lot of players' lists.
Many years of losing makes a fan a little paranoid, so I ask this question knowing that I am, and you may become one soon. Yeah. Is there any thought of, you know, Jan Erickson played with the Rangers. Is there any thought of, you know, maybe somebody getting a message to young Erickson, any tampering, or do you just think this was the decision the kid made and had decided with his agent not to sign?
There has been, you know, speculation that there could have been tampering. Of course, that's what it is, speculation. No, nobody can prove anything. It's entirely possible that Erickson always had New York as a sort of a dream destination and, you know, guided by his father's preference. And when it came down to the wire and his agent said, you know what, we have leverage here, and if you still want to go to New York, if you don't like what's happening in Calgary, I can probably make that happen just by, you know, pressing Feaster. So, I mean, I think the agent probably did what a good agent should do and made things happen for his client, but there's definitely some feelings here in town that perhaps some hanky-panky went on behind the scenes.
It has to, and I'm not saying hanky-panky, but it has to be something that was outside of the contract and the CBA, because these contracts write themselves, right? The bonuses are basically in there based on, you know, where you were selected in the draft.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the Flames in negotiating with Erickson basically had their hands tied. I mean, one of the issues that was brought up by Jay Feaster when he was interviewed afterwards was the player wanted guarantees that he was going to come over and play for the team. And, of course, you can't exactly write that into any contracts because entry-level deals are, you know, they're 3 years. They're, by default, they're two-way contracts. And, you know, all Feaster and the Flames could do is give them their word that, you know, Erickson would make the team and wouldn't be sent down because of cap issues. But, you know what, that's not worth a lot to a young player who wants to play
right.
and has seen a team like the Flames battle the salary cap the last few years and not really promote very aggressively their kids from within. So
let's change the subject a little bit. There's a rumor, and you've had it up for a few days now over at Flames Nation, that the Flames are about to hire Craig Hartsburg. Tell me about that and what you think it means possibly down the line to the team.
Yeah, I haven't. I've thought about it a little bit. I'm not sure how to evaluate Hartsburg. He has sort of an interesting, spotty resume where he's definitely enjoyed some success at some levels in junior. He's coached for the World Junior Championships a couple times, won some gold medals. But he's also had some rough patches in the NHL. I think most recently with Ottawa, where I don't even think he lasted a year with them.
No.
And the other thing I don't know right now is, once he's hired, what his role will be within the organization. You know, is he going to take forward defense? Is he going to do special teams? So at this point, I'm certainly not unhappy about the potential to hire a guy like Hartsburg. He has a good enough resume where you can think he could come in and not really do any damage to the team at the least. So.
Well, and Feaster, this was his first, the Erickson situation was his first calamity sort of thing. Hartsburg would be, I think, his first, you know, him beginning to put the coaching staff together in his own image, or at least what he wants to see there. Is it a low with the Sutters being there? Is there a situation, or is there a sense that the power of the Sutters is lessening, or and this might be part of that, or is it just, hey, listen, this is a guy who's available?
Yeah, it's hard to evaluate that only because Feaster's been in charge for a couple of weeks now, at least officially. Who knows how long he's been unofficially in charge behind the scenes. But I have a strong feeling that this hire is, if it happens, is guided more by Brent Sutter, because I think he's worked with Hartsburg in the past.
Okay.
And I think it's fair for head coaches to have a lot of input into the associate coaches they'll be working with anyway. So in terms of the first couple of moves by Feaster, I don't know. I think we're really going to be able to see during the draft, which is where Daryl Sutter had a lot of influence, a lot of obvious habits that he pursued over the years. And in free agency, I mean, that's where Jay Feaster can really start making his mark and signal to the world and to the fans that there has been a change in philosophy.
And there's now, because of the trade, the one, you know, really positive thing is you go from having one pick 13th in the top whatever, you've got three inside the top, what, 60 now?
Yeah, and that's, I think Daryl Sutter only ever had two second-round picks his entire tenure because he always traded them away. So, yeah, that's I guess, a nice... nice little bonus.
Is there also a sense that the Flames might drop another shoe, like a trade in the summer? And you and I, every time we talk about this, and I don't mean to, you know, I have a great deal of respect for the Flames team. It's a veteran team. But a Regier or a Kiprusoff possibly also being dealt just because of the cap problem and maybe in exchange for a player and a pick?
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Feaster's made a lot of noise about trying to keep the team competitive, you know, keeping a good core together. But I went over the cap issues for the Flames a couple weeks ago, and they're significant. I mean, they have a number of players they want to resign. Tanguay's probably first amongst those now that Glenn Cross has been out of the way. And they don't have, I think they have 7 or 8 million in terms of total cap space to do it. And it comes down to about maybe $1 million per player if you average it out, and that's not a lot of cap space to try to fill out a roster with. So I think at some point they're going to be forced, even if they, you know, demote boat anchors like Alex Kotelik or Nicholas Hagman, they're still going to be forced to make some sort of move in order to, I mean, if they want to be competitive next year, and if they don't want replacement level players playing throughout the roster, they're going to have to make some cap space one way or the other.
Okay. What about the other prospects in the system? We had an extended look at that the Reinhardt kid, so the cupboard isn't completely bare. For Flames fans listening right now, is there anybody else on the horizon that Flames fans are excited about?
Personally, I really like TJ Brody. He's a defenseman. He's not very big, but he's very good with the puck. He's offensively minded. He can skate really well. He almost made the team last year. He was up with the big squad for about a 3-game cup of coffee at the beginning of the season, which is notable because he was 20 years old at the time, hadn't played any professional hockey, and the Flames were pretty stacked on the back end in terms of veteran players. So personally, I'm really high on TJ Brody. You mentioned Max Reinhardt, who had quite a breakout season. He was a third-round pick, but he performed really well this year. I think he led his team in scoring in both the regular season and the playoffs, or he was at least top two. So that's definitely nice for Flames fans. Ryan House is also sort of a one-dimensional sniper, but the Flames don't even have any of those really in the hopper. So he scored 52 goals, I believe, in the WHL this year. So there's some pieces there. The question is, how are they going to develop and are they actually going to be high-impact players?
Right. Let's change gears a little bit and talk about something you wrote about maybe 10 days ago or so with regard to Behind the Box Score, Sports Illustrated, NHL GMs, and Corsi Blindness that you wrote for Houses of the Hockey. Fascinating article. Tell us a little bit about the background and tell us why you wanted to sit down and write that and the point you wanted to make.
Yeah, sure. Certainly. I mean, Sports Illustrated came out with an article at the time, I think it was the same day it was posted, just interviewing a number of nameable GMs in the NHL, discussing the importance of puck possession, why it's become sort of the holy grail in terms of what to track in the NHL and how it correlates with winning. The funny thing about the article was he said that there was no consensus amongst NHL GMs on how to actually quantify possession. That's funny because a lot of amateur analysts around the web have been, dealing with Corsi and its variants for, I think it's going on 4 or 5 years now. And there's been a lot of work put in by people like Gabe Desjardins, Victor, myself, and there's a whole bunch of other guys getting in on it now all over the league. So I found it funny that NHL GMs wouldn't be aware of all this sort of work that's been done. Now, saying that, who knows if they're actually being completely open and honest with the gentleman who wrote the article, because I know that Desjardins actually works for a couple of NHL teams behind the scenes. So it would stun me if there's nobody in the executive offices across the league looking at this stuff.
Well, I think that you'd find, this is a guess, but I think you'd find, just like with baseball and advanced statistics, when I remember the Mets being totally into them by like 1986 or something like that, and there were other organizations that were painfully unaware about things beyond platoons and that sort of thing. So I think it's probably a mixed bag across the National Hockey League. But what I got out of it was the I keep looking for the, and you mentioned it in the article, the Bill James, magic set of numbers where you can say, okay, this, and this, and you've got the equivalencies, and there's like five or six different tools or, items in the magic bag of Bill James. I think we're getting closer here, and one of the things that really is being defined is the Corsi number or the REL Corsi, where you can actually not necessarily compare across teams, but team to team to find out who's driving the bus and who's zooming who. And do you think we'll advance to the point where there are statistics that are universally accepted where, in the newspaper you might get a box car where it's games played, goal assist points, and then a REL Corsi?
I think we're definitely getting closer. I mean, I still, to some degree, think we're groping around blindly in the dark. We're just a little less blind than we were 5 or 10 years ago. You always get a feeling when you do this type of work that you're never going to be completely right. You're just being less wrong with every new step along the way. I mean, one of the problems with hockey and sports in general is you can't run actual controlled scientific experiments because you can't control the variables. You always have to go back and look at stats and correlations, and you have to see if they persist over time, and it's very, you have to tease out the relationships. You have to make sure that, you know, they're causal and not just coincidental. So it's sort of a long, grueling process where you can sort of be led down a lot of blind alleys. That's actually where you get the benefit of, you know, networked, open sort of work that we get with the amateur analysts on the web, where, you know, one guy writes something and he gets 50 comments behind it saying this is what's right and this is what's wrong. And that's maybe why NHL teams might be lagging in this sense, because as we've heard, they have their own ways of doing things, but they're closed, they're insular, they don't share it with anyone. And it makes sense for them to do that, to have proprietary knowledge, but on the other hand, it puts them sort of behind, because they can't get the sort of collaborative work that we get, which is interesting.
Well, I find it, you know, having, you know, been in, you know, my particular business for years and years and years, and being a little older, I can tell you that a lot of things get brushed away with the following phrase, that's why we've always done it that way. So I think there may be organizations, and I'll use Harold Ballard's Leafs as an example, where they simply would not move into the next century simply because they'd always done it a particular way. And I think there is a sort of an inbuilt arrogance for some teams in the National Hockey League, and, you know, it may be decades before they adopt any of this stuff. Final item I wanted to talk, you wrote something called The Importance of Manny Malhotra on the Houses of the Hockey as well, and I wanted to get your input about him coming back possibly tonight, and what kind of impact you'd think he would have first game back, obviously in the faceoff circle and maybe with a penalty kill. But what are your thoughts on Malhotra coming back possibly?
I think that could be a really big bump for Vancouver. Not that they need it. I mean, I still think they're the best team in the league, and I consider them the favorites for the cup even when he's not in the lineup. That said, he's the sort of guy that bumps everyone throughout the depth chart up in a way, because he makes all their jobs easier. I mean, even Ryan Kessler, who is a legitimate Selke trophy nominee, his job is made a lot easier by Malhotra. I mean, Malhotra spends a whole bunch of time in the defensive zone. He's a great face-off guy. And it just means that everyone else can spend more time in the offensive zone, including the Sedin twins, who already, you know, are gifted some pretty good circumstances by their coach. But with Malhotra, it means, you know, a lot less defensive zone face-offs for those guys and a lot more offensive zone face-offs. So, you know, it sort of tilts the ice slightly more in Vancouver's favor.
Are you ready for a statue of Mike Gillis overlooking English Bay?
I'm trying not to think about the celebrations that are going to come. I mean, still cheering for Boston, but I have to face the inevitable here, I think.
Man, I'm going to get into soccer. Hey, Kent, thanks so much. We appreciate your time very much.
My pleasure, Alan.
All right. Kent Wilson from Flames Nation and all kinds of different spots on the internet. Interesting guy. Really has done some great research, along with folks that have been mentioned on today's show, like Dennis King and Vic Ferrari, and obviously Gabriel Desjardins, who has been a great source for all of us in terms of information available on the internet. Coming up before the top of the hour, it's 1:44, and we're going to talk to Jeff Crichel about the NHL Combine next.